Good morning. I will admit this is not my first time standing in a church pulpit. Around the time I was 4, I regularly, after church worship services were over, made my way to the pulpit, dragged a chair over so I could see over it, and preached whatever was on my mind to the 3 or 4 church ladies who were polite enough to stay in their pews and listen to what a preschooler had to say. My father at the time was the minister at Old First Presbyterian Church of Huntington, New York, so I a little bit had run of the place. I grew up in a household where we read the Bible and said prayers and attended Sunday school. We were encouraged to question what we were taught and to experience other faith traditions and to never believe that your beliefs were the right ones just because you were the one that held those beliefs. What did the Lord require of me? He required I seek justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with my God. You would think this strong religious upbringing would make me perfectly confident to talk with you now about this that I believe. You would be wrong. I often feel like a fraud in a situation like this. I also almost failed my first religion class I ever took in college. I spent most of my 20s without a church home. And in Sunday school, I'm always the first person to raise my hand and start a question with, I'm sure I'm already supposed to know this, but. Case in point, when I was called to be a deacon here at Morningside, no one was more surprised than I was. And as part of preparation for that, the soon-to-be deacons and elders are called into preparation and training classes for a few months before their ordination. Church leadership asked us on our first meeting if we would talk a little bit about a Bible passage that represented our faith journey or the way faith guides us daily. So we went around the table, and you should have heard it. Psalm 23 this, and John 14 that, and all kinds of people had John 3, 16, 21, like that was the bonus answer that was going to get you extra credit. And I slunk lower and lower in my chair, feeling like I had gotten this one really wrong. My Bible verse was Genesis 8, 6 through 12. I will save you the trouble of reaching for your pew Bibles, because you're not going to know this. It's the story of Noah. It's kind of the middle of the story of Noah. It's after the whole build a boat, rain, animals 2 by 2, and it's before the rainbow, go repopulate the earth part. It's the part when they'd been at drift in the water for some time, and Noah sent out a dove. And the dove came almost immediately back because there was nowhere for it to go. After waiting 7 days, Noah sent the dove out again, and this time it came back with an olive branch, and this was a sign that there had to be at least a tree line that was above the water now. And 7 days later, God sent out that dove, and the dove never came back. And that's how Noah knew it was going to be time to get off the boat and start again. To me, that's God telling Noah, look, I know this stinks right now. You're out in this boat. You're sick of being surrounded by water. Here's a bird with a twig. That's a sign. It's going to get better. It's not good now, but it's going to get better. I believe that's a message that God has for us all, that there are times when the water is high and it's hard to get beyond your despair, but there is always going to be hope. There will always be a dove that brings you an olive branch. My arrival here at Morningside came at a time when I was adrift in my own ark, feeling my own hopelessness and despair. My husband Jason and I had recently bought our first home together, and not long afterwards, armed robbers broke in during the afternoon while we were at work. They shot our dog in the head. He died on the spot. They took some of our possessions, but none of that was as bad as taking our sense of confidence and our sense of peace and our family pet. But a week and a half after the break-in, Jason had plans to be out of town, and while I was putting on a very brave face, I wasn't prepared to stay in the house by myself yet, so I went all the way OTP to my parents' house in Marietta. And while I was there, they said, well, on Sunday, we're checking out this church in Virginia Highlands. Why don't you come with us? And so I trudged to this place on too little sleep, often drinking too much wine, in this cloud of anxiety and despair. I don't remember a lot about the sermon that Sunday, but I do remember it was about fear. And I will always remember Joanna Adams saying this, fear is the enemy of hope. And I remembered in that moment, God always sends a dove with an olive branch. There is always hope. And in that moment, this church became that dove for me. God's way of telling me it's not okay right now, but have hope, it will get better. For years, Jason and I tried to start our family through adoption. And if you've ever been through that or known somebody who's been through it, it's not like you just put your name on a list and take next available kid. It's actually requires a lot of paperwork and dossiers, and you actually have to go to the Department of Homeland Security, and they send people to check out your home. And for us, it involved a lot of heartbreak and a lot of obstacles in our path when we were starting a family. When I found out I was expecting my son, I said to a confidant, I can't really get my hopes up. And she said, why? And I said, because I will just be so disappointed if something happens and this doesn't work out. And she said, aren't you going to be disappointed anyway? Hope is God's gift for you right now. Why not revel in how wonderful the hope is? And again, that was my dove with an olive branch. There is a flip side to believing that God is hope, and that's believing that you are a vessel for God's hope to others. Being someone's dove of hope does not require grand earth-shattering measures. It means that you visit someone and bring them lunch when they're recovering from surgery. It means you tell someone, I believe in you, or you can do it, or I know it's going to get better. It's volunteering, it's tithing, it's sitting at the lunch table with the kid who has no one else to sit with. It's standing up for someone who's oppressed when you have nothing to gain. It's standing up for what's right long before it's popular. Hope is in one of my favorite expressions. It says, if you see someone who isn't wearing a smile, give them yours. This is what I believe. I believe God would never send you adrift in an ark without a plan for you. God will always send you a dove with an olive branch. God will always give you hope. And we are all God's vessels to bring hope to others. I wasn't going to tell this story, but the friend is here. When I was 23, I went to a tattoo parlor down in Little Five Points, because that seems like a really good idea when you're 23. I got a tattoo of a dove with an olive branch because I wanted a physical reminder every day that there is hope, but also wanted the physical reminder every day that it is my responsibility to bring hope to others. Pray each day for God to give you hope and for the strength to be the beacon of hope for others. Be someone else's dove with an olive branch. This I believe.
I had a vote of confidence when I was coming up here. My 13-year-old said, you're preaching the sermon? And I said, yeah, I am. And she said, keep it short. So, sorry. My name is Lisa Jern, and I've been attending Morningside for about 10 years since my girls were in preschool here, and have been we've been members just about as long. For me, as I suspect for a lot of us, my faith and what I believe has a lot of nooks and crannies, but I'll share one of those this morning. I consider myself sort of a pragmatist. I can be on the cynical side, but I believe in miracles. By miracles, I'm not talking about tears on a Madonna statue in Italy, and I'm not talking about a billboard on Ponce de Leon with the face of Christ and a plate of spaghetti. Baron, that may have been before your time, but I'm not sure that we converted any non-believers on that day. Technically, miracles are probably defined, if you were going to define them, as something that cannot be explained by nature. I'd like to define them a little bit differently for me. I believe a miracle is God's intimate, intentional involvement in my life in ways that are not possible without God. Intentional involvement in my life in ways that aren't possible without God. People have been writing about and talking about and thinking about miracles, I guess, for thousands of years. One of my favorites, C.S. Lewis, has a beautiful, logical, spiritual book called Miracles that's a wonderful sort of exploration of the topic. When I was thinking about this, and I hadn't thought about this a lot in my spiritual journey, but I went to my bookshelves to see if there was anything. Do you ever do that? See if there was anything that would enlighten me. And I literally found a book called A Course in Miracles, and it is a textbook, a workbook, a manual on miracles. So I thought, God, people have been thinking about this a lot more than me. But there's not going to be a test. I'm going to save that for later. Those of us who have kids, or those of us who are young enough to remember being kids, probably have been faced with those questions of what are, maybe not what are miracles, but God and the universe and Jesus. When I was, when the girls were about 4 or 5 years old, I was making dinner, and Libby said, just out of the blue, as I guess these questions usually are, "Mom, who made Jesus?" And I thought, oh, okay, I can do this. And I said, "Well, God made Jesus." Do you guys remember this? They said, I said, "God made Jesus." And not anticipating the next question, which is obviously, well, then, who made God? And I thought, oh boy, okay, how am I going to get out of this? And I said, "Well, honey, that's a mystery." And then Kate weighs in with the, you know, the eye roll that I had to get used to very early on. But she weighs in and she says, "Mom, God is not a mystery. Scooby-Doo is a mystery." So, Baron, Drew, if they come up to you after church, just go get some punch or something, because I never answered the question. In all seriousness, I do think miracles, like religious faith, are not subject to scientific proof. Hebrews 11:1 says, "Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." But for me, it's simple. I look at my faith and the universe and existence, and I think, surely those things are big enough to capture miracles and creation and a creator. So for me, it's simple. And I believe in those kind of grand, jaw-dropping miracles like creation and the birth of Christ and the foundation of Christianity. So I believe in jaw-dropping miracles, but I also believe in daily miracles. And for me, and probably for a lot of us, I think, music is that kind of daily miracle, whether it's a Mozart Requiem or a Bach cello suite for me, or Mahalia Jackson or Eric Clapton or Willie Nelson, but pick your person. I think music is that kind of miracle, and it's not, to me, something that can stop wars, although maybe, or change the course of history, although maybe. But I think music is the kind of daily miracle that can preserve your soul when there is war and hardship and illness or just a bad day. And for me, music is that kind of miracle. So I believe in daily miracles. And I'll close with this. I believe in personal miracles. When I was 30 years old, I was diagnosed with stage 4 breast cancer. If there had been a stage 5, I would have been diagnosed with that. I went through chemo and radiation and surgery and more chemo and radiation and surgery for about 3.5 years. And during my last chemo, I went into cardiac arrest. And at the end of that, when I had recovered, my ejection fraction, which is basically your ability to pump blood, my ejection fraction was 12%, which maybe needless to say is not very good. And my doctors at that time told me that I would not have children. I would not be able to have children. And 18 months later, I was pregnant with twins. And when my cardiologist picked himself off the ground, having, as he said, had a heart attack about the whole situation, Dr. Brown put it in very stark terms for me. He said, "There is a 50% chance that you will not survive the pregnancy and a 75% chance that the girls will not survive the pregnancy." And I told the girls I wouldn't cry. Kate said she would laugh at me if I cried, so I'll try not to. But you would think that up until now, that's the miracle that I'm talking about, and that's probably right, and I had a lot of people who were praying for me. I had very good doctors. But to me, the miracle is this. I'm not a risk taker. I listen to my doctors. I'm a lawyer. I avoid risk for people. And yet, at the riskiest point in time in my life and the most important decision in my life, I had no doubt. No doubt. And that, to me, is God's miracle in my life and his intentional involvement in my life. And now we have miracle babies. A friend of ours called them, at one point, Wonder Twins, but we thought that that set the bar a little too high. So we went back to miracle babies. I'll close with this final quote. William Sloan Coffin is a peace activist and civil rights activist and longtime Christian stalwart, and he once said this, "I'm convinced that gratitude is the most important religious emotion. When you're grateful for the undeserved beauty of a cloudless sky, you're praying. And I'm grateful for miracles, and I'm grateful for the miracles that I think are happening in this church. Thank you.
Good morning. I believe that Barron had a serious lapse in judgment letting me up here. For those of you who don't know, I'm Alex Page. My wife and I joined the church 2 years ago, and we got married here last November. I'm a TV censor for a late night show and a violinist in a band, hence my trepidation that with my working knowledge of terrible words that I hopefully I don't go off script. And I used most of those words this morning when my printer broke, hence the iPad. I struggle with a very strange dichotomy in Christianity. God is all-inclusive, but somehow we as Christians have made it so that Christ excludes the majority of the world. I'll take you back 6 years and how I came onto this line of thinking. 6 years ago, the Dalai Lama held a summit for happiness at Emory, and I attended, along with several thousand other people. And to open this ceremony, a representative from every major world religion gave a blessing in their native tongue or a verse from the document of their religion. So this would be Buddhist, Hindi, Islam, Jewish, Catholic, and Protestant messages. For 20 minutes, several thousand people prayed with bowed heads, and we progressed through prayers. And the final prayer was from an 18-year-old Methodist Southern belle. And not once in her prayer did she mention God, as all the other religions had. She only referenced Christ. And slowly throughout her prayer, I noticed heads lifting up, people stopping their prayer and their meditation, including myself, because I felt very uncomfortable knowing that we had just excluded several thousand people in one room from our own prayer. And the discomfort that I experienced was life-changing. I was embarrassed, and I fell away from the church, and I stopped going, and I didn't want my faith to disassociate myself with the people around me, especially at a school like Emory, where it is a mixing pot. Well, let's fast forward 3 years, 2011. I'm on the road performing with my band. It was kind of a low point in the tour. We had been out on the road for 3 months without being at home, and we were tired and hungry. We had just driven overnight, actually for 2 days, from Missouri, and we hadn't gotten off the bus since then, and we only had 3 hours in San Francisco. So this is a 23-hour drive. We had 3 hours to sightsee in San Francisco, a city I'd never been to, and I was really looking forward to. And so the second we get off the bus, I grab a buddy of mine, Joey. He is our Latin percussionist, bongos, that kind of stuff. And he's a self-described recovering Catholic. and I convince him to go blindly through the city to find the bay and to see the Golden Gate Bridge and to grab a bite to eat. This was the height of summer. And like I said, we were not in a good mood already. And we hiked what we thought was a straight line on Google Maps towards the bay. If you've ever been to San Francisco, you know how, well, it's not a straight line, and there is a large hill in the center of that, which we didn't see on the map. If you haven't been, the hill is so steep that there are treads on the sidewalk to keep you from rolling backwards down it. So we struggled up this hill, and we have to wear all black and white while we're on tour. Our tuxedo is our uniform. So it's hot, we're wearing all black, and we are struggling up this hill, and we are in a very bad mood. We reach the top of the hill, and a huge gust of ocean breeze hits us. And directly in front of us is this amazingly gorgeous and overly large church, this cathedral. Come to find out, it's Grace Cathedral, which is a tourist stop in San Francisco. But we didn't know that at the time. It was just an unexpected sight. And the breeze, something about it, said, let's walk towards it. And as we got closer, we noticed the doors were open. And we heard a faint sound coming through it. And it was their organist practicing. Just happened to be one of my favorite pieces, which, ironically, or coincidentally, whichever you prefer, the postlude today is actually an homage to this piece. It is Vidor's Toccata from Symphony No. 5. And we walk into the doors and we sit down and the air conditioning feels incredible. And we just sit there in silence for 30 minutes. We don't say a word. We just take in the music. He goes through Bach and Mozart. And as we've cooled down, we're less angry and somehow less hungry. And we get up to leave, and my friend Joey turns to me and he says, you know what? I don't always like God, but he's there when I need it. We don't always like God in our everyday lives. Terrible things happen. But God is there when we need it. So this is what I believe. That Christ didn't walk among us so that we could write his name in history books and debate the nuances of his stories and the minute details of translations that have been lost through time. He came here to set an example for us, to urge us to continue his work, plain and simple, to reach out to the outsiders, to comfort the sick and the distressed, to enrich the lives of those who are poor of life. I believe we're called not to spread his name, but to spread his love. And not with grand gestures, as we've mentioned, of building a house once a year with Habitat, or doing community labor, or dedicating a weekend here and there. Those are all great things. I highly suggest you do it. And this church is a great outlet for those things. But we are called every second of every day to be mindful of God's people, which is every person on this planet throughout all of history, and to make them feel welcome and respected, no matter how different they are from ourselves. I think that's why Morningside is such a great place and such an amazing community, because it's so welcoming of people that believe many different things. I'll leave on this note. Every time my dad dropped me off for school, in elementary school, right as I was getting out of the car, he would lean over, yell out the window, have good, be fun. It always just seemed like a clever way of saying what every parent says to their kid, which is basically don't destroy anything and try not to be a brat. Which I was. But now that I'm older, that phrase has stuck with me, and it's come to mean something different. Have good in your heart and be joyous. I think that's what our call from God is. It's that every day, when he lets us out into the world, have good and be fun.